Welcome back to Winning with Data. I'm your host, Jake Schuster.
Hey, Alec Coughlin here.
And we are joined by Matthew Lacombe from Parma Calcio. What's up, Matthew?
Hey, I'm good. How are you guys?
Excellent. And our boy Suds over in Atalanta.
Yeah, how's it going?
Great to have you both. I'm going to start over on the French side of the table here. You're at the top of the standings right now, inching closer to a title. And you're, what, 2.5 years into a project there. Tell us about what's happening at Parma, what's driven the success and the role that you've played.
First and foremost, the season is not over, so let's have some mood. We're still 5 games to go. So basically what we are doing on the data side, and I think what is helping the team to perform, or at least the club to perform as a whole, is that we are supporting both the staff, the directors, and the top management of the club in creating alignments in between the different parts of the club, either by providing insights or by providing reporting stuff or creating tools for them. But I think the main important point for a football club is, again, to align from top management and what the club wants to do, to realize scouting strategy, how we train on the pitch, how we play, and how we develop the players. So basically all the main pillars of the club are aligned around the common methodology and the common way of looking at the game. So basically this is what we try to do here. And I'm just more than convinced that the more you have this, the more chances you have to be successful on the pitch.
Suds, you've been in two different Southern European environments. You know, you've had great success in Portugal. You've been in Italy for a couple of years. What are the biggest lessons that you've learned about being in a data role in a European soccer club?
I think the most important thing is just slow and steady. A lot of people always want to be at the forefront. They want to be involved. But honestly, there's so much juice that you can squeeze just kind of sitting in the background, being in the shadow, just preparing for the moment when someone's actually saying, knocking on your door and saying, hey, actually, what do you have on your plate, or what do you have to share? Maybe a lot of times we data hat people can get quite proud or get quite excited, because maybe sometimes working with data you can find insights and you can find cool results to show. Sometimes you just got to keep your mouth shut and just keep working and keep building for the day when someone knocks on the door and says, hey, I'm ready, you know, because at the end of the day, you show up to work, you're there every day. You see them for lunch, they see you for lunch. So they know you exist, they know you're there. So maybe on day one, maybe they're not going to completely understand what is the 100% value that you're bringing in. But over time, because you're not, you know, working remotely, you're there every day, you're with them every day. Your preparation for that day when they knock on the door is key. And this is maybe something that I've learned in those Southern European environments.
Yeah, I'd love to expand on that. You know, something I often notice is, like, just because an organization runs some media stories about a couple of things that they're doing with analytics, and I'm using air quotes, doesn't mean that the whole org is doing that, or doesn't mean that the most important decisions are using that. Or just because an organization has hired some really reputable data scientists doesn't mean that they're going to be influential from day one. So I'd love to hear you expand on what organizational change looks like and the biggest things that you've learned in being a part of that.
Organizational change, I think, just is perhaps simply measured by the KPI of just the number of touch points that people have with data. So that could be, you know, the number of meetings that you're involved in, or the number of meetings that data is presented, or the number of, let's say, executive dashboards that are created, and, you know, telemetry around just the number of touch points where data exists. For me, that would be sort of the, you know, one metric that you would use for being able to measure organizational change. So, you know, you might go from one touch point where data is used like once in a while to maybe having it just more integrated into the day-to-day environment. And so in Pentica, it was primarily working with the match analysts, to the first team match analysts day to day. And then here, it's just a little different. The main flavor of the day here is the transfer market. So I would say if I had to just distill it into that one metric, it would be the number of touch points.
I will jump on this one because after the first 18 months, we were working on the phase two strategy at the club. And so we had a kind of a big meeting with the guys here, and we were brainstorming which direction do we want to take? One direction was, okay, do we want to get into more and more complex analytics? Or do we want to increase usage of the analytics by more people? And we just said, okay, our first metric need to be how many people are using our dashboards and are using our, let's say, analytics. So we really push for usage. So now we are more than a bit because head of UC is using, head of scouting is using, managing director of sport is using our analytics, game analysts are using. And then when they start to use it and they start to be educated, you can bring them in the journey with you. And this is where you start to get into more education, more complex questions, and then you start to grow your impact. But trying to get into more what we used to call opt-up pro form, like research questions, super complex stuff, without getting the usage first. You risk to go on the moon, but keep the people on the ground and can put your organization at stake, because at some point you start to develop something that no one's care about, no one's not even understand. And then you start to be the cost center to cut for people because no one is using you.
Just to give one experience I've had sort of working in sort of environments like this is, you know, when you focus on those like complex questions first without sort of focusing on usage and increasing the number of touch points, you can often sometimes get a response from people like, oh, well, that's just your opinion, you know, and maybe you actually built a phenomenal model, a phenomenal machine learning model or phenomenal statistical analysis. But if someone really doesn't understand from like step one to step 10, how you arrived to that result, someone could just come to you and be like, okay, well, that's just your opinion. And so it's important to sort of understand that these touch points are really important to sort of increase objectivity of data, as opposed to just having someone who's not so technical just view data as just another opinion in the room.
Right. Yeah, I appreciate that, Suds. And both of you are, you know, led right into the question I had. So, Matthew, I just want to ask you to build on what your first comment was, which I really appreciated, talking about you're constantly building a common way to look at the team, the sport, you know, the everything, right? So alignment makes a ton of sense. The question I have for you, and you don't need to be too specific, obviously, for obvious reasons, though, is how do you know when the data and the touch points you're introducing are starting to evolve, you know, the thinking, right? And or behavior associated with improving, right? And I know that's like if you just show people a bunch of numbers, wow, that's like genius stuff. That's great. Now go away. I have to deal with putting stuff on the grass because I don't have time for this. It doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah. No, these come always with a question that I think ownership group are asking, how can we make sure that you have a real impact on decisions? And to be honest, this is something that is very, let's say, tough to measure. It's not as easy as like creating a simple return on investment metric. But at some point is that you just need to look at the content you are producing, how many times as well the end user are requesting the information. So we were producing, for example, like trend game analysis report, and then we have our MD sport that is asking for it something like every week. So for us, it's a good sign to say, okay, if he's asking for it every week, that it's serving his own decision-making model. We are able to create some success story of things that have happened that is very important for us and say, okay, we tried to influence the coach on this and this, and we were able to document all this process and say, okay, we were saying, I don't know, we should remove this high press and reduce it and so on. And that sometimes, and I'm not saying it's our decision, that sometimes the coach ended up making the decision, which is to reduce his pressing, which is his decision again. But because we have all this documentation, we are saying, okay, we were able to support this decision. We were in the conversation with him, we were supporting him. It's such process. He made the decision, but we were part of this. And same for us now on scouting and player acquisitions. I will never be the one that put the trigger on saying, okay, we're going to buy or not. But I'm part of the conversation. We are doing all the due diligence on the players. This is requested before every signing. And we fight with the head scout for some players that did not look great, but that we were backing up from the scouting reports and that, and we fight together. And then, okay, we can tell some success story like that. So at some point, it's important for us to monitor the decision-making process, monitor what we are doing to make sure that when things are going in the right side, because you don't have these metrics to be able to turn this return on investment or monitor this return on investment to be able to tell you a nice story. I'm not sure I was super clear, but...
No, you nailed it. Because what I'm hearing, and this is the stuff that I think our audience really particularly enjoys, you have a framework and you keep score against that framework associated with very important decisions that are made, and whether or not the decision actually is or isn't affected by what you introduce is something that you guys strive to continue to improve and grow upon, which makes all the sense in the world. And I think that's a great way to describe it. So I appreciate that. Suds, I wonder, do you have any feedback on that, you know, or any thoughts to build on it? Because I imagine you might think about things within frameworks as well, or maybe you think about it differently, but would be curious for your thoughts on what Matthew just shared.
I agree. I think whether it's week to week games or whether it's the transfer market, sports is inherently a prediction market. So you're either making predictions via data or you're making predictions through subjective expertise. And so, you know, through subjective expertise, maybe you record your predictions qualitatively through text and through video and through things like this. And through data, maybe you record your predictions via numbers or graphs or whatever. But at the end of the day, regardless of what hat you're wearing, it's a prediction market. You know, we're going to play a game on Thursday and there's going to be a certain, you know, pre-match predictions for a percentage that we're going to win the game, percentage that we're going to draw, percentage. And, you know, you can derive that number via subjective expertise and you can derive that number via numbers. So in order to build that trust, in order to build sort of long-term alignment, it is very important to archive, sort of not be afraid and archive as many times as possible. What do the numbers say? And even if it's not listened to or even if it's not used, it's okay. Like there will be a moment where you do reflections and you do sort of like a review of, okay, you know, were the predictions correct in the past? And this is where, you know, you need to be ready to step up and shine and say, yeah, the numbers that I actually had were good or not. The same thing from the subjective expertise side. People who derive their predictions via their subjective expertise, the same thing, which is why we have things like scouting databases and, you know, match analysis reports and things like this. So for me, it's all about, you know, not being afraid to sort of put down your opinion regardless of how you arrive to it and allowing your sort of corpus of work to speak for itself when it's the right time to reflect.
Yeah. And what about the format of that? So you used the term executive dashboard earlier, and I totally agree with the KPI of touch points. I know that there's lots of content and folks out there talking about data visualization, but not as much specifically just about, you know, does it have to be a visualization? Should it be a single number? You know, we work in a league with partners that they openly admit if something can't be printed out on a clipboard, nobody will look at it. Yeah. So how have you all worked in your environments, or rather what best practices do you personally believe in that makes sense for end users, for ultimate decision makers, where some people like stoplights, red, yellow, green, some people like a single number? How do you really, in how you work with the end user?
So, okay. I see the clickbuster is a fair point, but we have different way of interacting with the people depending on, of course, the audience and what they have to do. But so, of course, we have a dashboard, formal paper report that can go to like a one-pager report to a 70-page report full of stats and so on. Then there is two things. When we interact with the coaches, we try to have like a formal touch point with them. So we send the report, we print the report for them. But for example, our game analyst will sit with him with the next summary of this report where everything is explained. And we said, okay, in 20 minutes, we will give you top content and we will walk you through all the steps in the report. And we do this on a weekly basis with the coaches. So this is one. Then let's say for key decision makers, it can go from like a due diligence report where I would go with 10 slides of data on players. But at the end, I know that the only thing that they are reading is my one-page summary, executive summary, because they have no time and they just want my opinion based on the data. But I see that for them, it's always good to understand that because I'm this kind of performance analytics guy, my executive summary is based on fact and it's based on data. So I'm always providing, let's say, this appendix of data to say, okay, what you have in this one pager is not my opinion, or it's my opinion based on all these facts. If you want to read all the additional facts, it's in there. But I think these kind of two things are important. So one is the report that you can automate it. And then it's at some point, I think it's why companies are bringing people with like more experience in senior position, like Sud or myself, is that they want to turn these things, this like 10-page report into an executive summary. And you want someone to write it and to explain to them this executive summary in a format they understand. And you need to sell your idea as well. So
I think everyone's different. I think this is where pedagogical empathy really shines, is that some people might like receiving, you know, a graph. Some people might receiving just a WhatsApp message, or some people would just like receiving a phone call. Once you build enough trust, you sometimes can work with people where someone will just come to you and say, look, you know, whether it's 3 a.m. or whether it's 6 p.m. or whether it's dinner time, if you got something super valuable to share, feel free to call me, you know, but just only call me when you're super certain. Don't call when it's experimental. And sometimes some people, you can get levels of trust with some people who are just like, if I need to ask you to show the evidence, okay, you can. But for now, I just really want to know, you know, what is that insightful thing that we can actually act on? Because at the end of the day, yeah, it's nice to produce dashboards, visuals, and all these things. But, you know, people want to know, what can I actually do with this information? So sometimes just even the text messages suffices. But that text message contains a lot of homework that has been done prior to you sending that text message.
A side story, but we moved from, okay, two different managing director spots. The first one, I was providing a 10-page report. I was telling, okay, I don't care about your report. Just tell me how the team is doing based on what you've seen. So it was just purely conversational. Then I moved to the second one and I started to have the same style. I said, no, I want to go through your 10-page report. We will talk about all these expected goals and all the stats and why do you think it's going in the right direction? So same role, two different people, and the output expected was very different.
Sorry to jump in, but that to you shows a very important aspect, is that, you know, regardless of how, you know, regardless of which country or culture, or regardless of how important data is within the organization, you need to have a key sponsor, you know, whether that's the CEO, whether that's the sporting director, whether that's, I don't know, the head coach. You know, you need to have one of those three in the triangle. You need to have someone that's going to bat for you when you're not in the room. So like that goes back to the touch point things, is like when you're not in meetings, you know, is data still being represented? And that usually happens if you have someone that goes to bat for you, or a key stakeholder that works well with you. So in Matthew's case, there was a managing director of sport who says, wait, let's go step by each of the things in the report. So that way, when I have conversations, when you're not around, your work is still represented in some form or fashion.
Such an important point. Have a sponsor for when you're not in the room. That's massive.
Yep.
So last major topic for today, Suds, you were working on natural language queries 10 years ago. And now the world knows about this kind of approach, this kind of, you know, user experience or attempt at it. You know, I'm fascinated in the gap between what people might post online about what they think is possible or what's possible in an edge case or as a prototype versus what's functionally feasible in a business environment. So I'd love to know, like, what did you think when you saw ChatGPT come out? And, you know, what do you think is the future of this kind of query or this kind of user experience in sporting environments?
And then, yeah, sure. I think, you know, nowadays you can tune your own GPT to industry-specific use cases. So I think everything now is about being able to answer, I would say, 90% of questions that can probably be answered like this, like quite quickly, and then leave the 10% of questions that probably need more time and need more modeling to be able to arrive to sort of competitive advantage results. So, you know, for example, if your data model was in a good setup and, you know, if you had everything tuned well to sort of like football specific or sports specific GPT model, it'd be very easy to just ask a question like, all right, which teams in the last 10 years have overperformed their wage bill, their wage expectation, like the expectation or the expected points that they would have relative to their wage bill. So with natural language processing or being able to ask natural language questions like this, you'd be able to just quickly answer tons of questions that senior people, owners tend to have, but they're not necessarily the questions that we should spend too much time working on to create competitive advantage. They're just helpful to like create context and educate people. So yeah, I think natural language can just be helpful for sort of tackling automatically a large subset of questions that owners and senior people have, but they're not necessarily the competitive advantage questions that data people could be working.
I would agree with that because like the way I see that kind of workflow, it's great if someone knocks on your door 3 times a day with a question, it means you're valued. If they knock on your door 30 times, you're probably not going to get anything done.
That's right. That's exactly how it is. Yeah. Especially when you're just a one man person that does all the analytics in the organization. So yeah.
Yeah. And Matthew, like when you talk about a 10 pager versus just talking over the outputs, you know, I often think about no one was standing around saying that they hate taxis and they hope that a stranger comes and picks them up in their car, right? So you know, using projection, knowing you don't have data to answer this question, do you see folks like sporting directors or head coaches or head scouts using this kind of natural language query product or those kind of capabilities in the future? Do you think that's a year away? Do you think that's 5 years away, 50 years away?
So it's always the same thing. I think technologically wise, kind of 1 year away, then you will have all the change managements that we need to take place. And then this can come at a 5 to 10 years span. So football, but sports in general is kind of 10 years behind in terms of tech of what the main tech company can do. So the problem is not about the tech, but it's more about how we can educate the people and educate them to ask the right question at the good time, frame them in the good way and just change their mentalities. We have some people that have been more, let's say, in the industry for the last 25 years and best of it their way. So now we first need to educate them, or, hey guys, we can have more like factual opinions on players or on the game or whatsoever. And then, okay, this opinion, you can get them from NLP and other way of kind of other models. So.
I think the biggest challenge there is that people want a miracle. You know, they want magic. They want everything to be easy and accessible and ready from day one. And, you know, these models need training. So I'm curious, just to finish, like, Suds, what have you learned in your time working on those kind of products about where expectations need to be set about training and tuning those kinds of models to be truly smooth in their experience?
I think the main thing I've learned is that if you're relying on this magic bullet, train tuned model, whatever you want to call it, if you're relying on this to create impact, you've already lost. You need to be generating impact already. And it's possible. I think that's the key thing, is that it's possible to create impact. You know, it's not like people were not able to take advantage of business opportunities, regardless of the industry, 20 years ago, before any of this technology was created. So you can be impactful without needing to necessarily use a super fancy technological tool. And that's always my philosophy. Because if you want to sort of get closer to being able to adopt sort of what is the forefront of technological solutions today, you want to create breathing space. And in order to create breathing space, you need to be impactful today. Otherwise, if you put all of your chips in this technological basket, you might end up, especially in sports, you might end up in a situation where people are like, well, this is taking a very long time to develop. It's, you know, a lot of things actually is, and Matthew will know this better than I will. There's so many Opta analytics research papers in sports science and tactics, which if you put that in front of an experienced coach, they'll just be like, yeah, well, no shit, Sherlock. Like, the result that you came up with is very obvious. You know, my 10, 15 years of experience already tells me what your machine learning model already has to say. So you want to be able to create breathing space, and that breathing space comes from those touch points, getting people engaged more often, getting the conversation going, and then you can have time to develop and tune your model, which then eventually can have impact. But to put all your chips in just this magic bullet AI solution.
No, I couldn't agree more. I think it should be a part of the puzzle, but not the main piece, without question. Matthew, Studs, thanks so much for your time today.